The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We were speaking this morning about Shabbat. And you will enjoy this, actually, Jay, because we're going to get a little textual.
Okay.
Yeah. And just two things that I want to get a sense of during this class. The first is how the Torah itself offers me a response to the ideas of Shabbat that we've mentioned. And second, I want to use this as an opportunity to gain a couple of insights into Torah study per se. In other words, obviously, ideally, you know, when I taught in different yeshivot, so I had a year course in how to learn Chumash. You know, there are many, especially in the yeshiva world, who think, well, you know, Chumash, you know, the Bible, Torah study, it's not a big deal, but Talmud, ooh, that's a big deal. And more often than not, they haven't really given much thought to how to study Bible, how to study Torah, and therefore they don't know what they're doing. And there's a beauty to a system of Torah study. And it takes a year to really become familiar with how to study Torah. So, obviously a week is not set up to give that, but nonetheless, there are certain things that you can glean, if only as a teaser. And if actually somebody at the end of a week here walks away with more of a desire to learn, then as far as I'm concerned, this whole week was worthwhile. Okay. But I wanted to first share with you one quick idea, which we didn't get to this morning, despite not having a break. The Zohar, the Book of Splendor, that I imagine Rabbi Aaron must have mentioned at some point, asks one of the same questions that we asked this morning, but gives a very different answer. He asks why it is that on Rosh Hashanah, we don't blow the shofar when it falls on Shabbat. If after all, as I mentioned this morning, the shofar is so central to the meaning of Rosh Hashanah, if it's such an intricate part of the power of penitence, then why don't I blow shofar not only even on Shabbat, but especially on Shabbat? And we presented our response. We talked about, you know, the fact that we don't carry and what carrying means and what the symbolism of carrying is. The Zohar gives a beautiful answer. And I think it's a good way to introduce some of the issues we're going to talk about. The Zohar, Book of Splendor, it's really the essence of all of it's the textual base for much of Jewish mysticism. And there's a lot of depth to it. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai wrote it. He was a Tana who lived in the time of the Roman Empire in the 2nd century CE, answers the question with another question. He says, why is it that when a festival holiday falls on Shabbat, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, if you're familiar with the liturgy, with the prayers, there's a central blessing on every holiday, which is really the basic blessing of that holiday. In other words, we have a central prayer, it's called Shmona Esrei. Right, the 18 benedictions. But on a holiday and on Shabbat, with the exception of Rosh Hashanah, we have 7 benedictions. On Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur, we have 9. And that 9 prayer, 7 prayer, 18 prayer unit called the Shmona Esrei, because that means 18, the silent Amidah, the silent standing prayer, that's really the center point of prayer. So in the central prayer of that central number of prayers is the prayer that deals with that particular day. For example, there's one on Shabbat, right? In fact, we saw it this morning. Shnei luchot avanim orid biado v'chein katuv b'hem shviat Shabbat. Right? Yismechu b'malchutcha, rejoice in your kingdom. That's the essence, the prayer of Shabbat. And there's also one for the holiday. There's one word that you add. Does anybody know what it is? There's one word that you add. It's in parentheses. That if the festival falls on a Shabbat, that you add a word to the festival prayer. And that word, and everybody knows this, but nobody even notices it. That word is ba'ahava, with love. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. If you've ever prayed and you ever noticed that. Why do I add the word ba'ahava, with love, when the festival falls on Shabbat? What, I don't love God. God doesn't love me. On a regular holiday? On Passover, God doesn't love me? It's the anniversary of the time when God took us out of Egypt? So what does that mean? So the Zohar says, there's a difference between the relationship that God and the Jewish people have on Shabbat and the relationship that God and the Jewish people have on a Yom Tov, on a festival. On a festival, the relationship is the relationship of erusin, of engagement. On a Shabbat, the relationship is the relationship of marriage. So what's the difference between the two? Engagement is very exciting. It's very emotional. I mean, you're all a tither, and you know, you can always spot when one of your students has just fallen in love with somebody because they're walking around with this dazed expression on their face, and they're banging into walls and tripping over things. You're all excited, and you know, it's the end of the day, and you can't wait to see your fiancé, and you're looking at your watch, you know, 3 minutes to 5, and you have these discussions late at night on the phone, and each one of you says goodbye to the other, and you can't get off the phone, and goodbye, goodbye, but we really have to say goodbye, and before you know it, it's 3 in the morning, and you bring her all these presents, chocolate and flowers and presents, everything, it's all exciting, right? I have this image of this. There used to be this Hallmark commercial. And the theme of this advertising campaign was, it's a Hallmark moment. So they have this commercial of a guy and a girl sort of running through a field, you know, slow motion, like they're full. Like that's a, oh, it's engagement. Marriage, you know, I don't know many husbands, 8, 9, 10, 15 years after they're married, that, you know, I'm taping this. This could be interesting, right? I don't know many husbands that, you know, they look at their watch at 5 o'clock and they're at 4:59, they're like, ah, I can't wait to get home to my wife. And if I would bring flowers, candy, and chocolates to my wife every day, she'd kill me. You know, I bring her every Shabbat, but I mean, you know. But of course, and when you're married, you give something much deeper to your wife. You give yourself. The relationship between a husband and a wife is a much deeper relationship. Talmud says, and people misunderstand this, Talmud says there's a halachic understanding of the relationship between husband and wife, ishto kigufo. His wife is like his own body. What does that mean? It means that I am she and she is me. You become one. In fact, the verse in Genesis says that God looks at man and says, lo tov hayot adam levado. It's not good that man should be alone. Eselo ezer kenegdo. I'm going to make him a life partner. And at the end of that whole story of the creation of Eve, it says, "Ve'azav v'ish et aviv ve'et imo," and a man should leave his family, "Ve'davak be'ishto," and he should cling to his wife, "Ve'hayu levasar echad," and they should become one. That's the essence, to become one. And so the relationship of Shabbat is a much deeper relationship. So the festivals are all exciting, and they come once a year. And you know, 30 days, there's a custom, it's really halakha, 30 days before a festival, you study the laws of the festival. And you know, look at any Jewish household, 2 weeks before Passover, and that's all they're talking about. And that's all they're doing, and there's cleaning, and there's thinking, and you buy the matzah, and you do this. And we have all these symbols, all these flowers and chocolate. We have matzah, and we have lulav, and we have shofar, and we have everything else. And it's very exciting. Shabbos! So Shabbos comes every week. And you know, you don't get all excited about Shabbat. But you know, I sometimes think, if Shabbat would come 5 minutes later, I wouldn't make it. We make it all year without the festival, but we couldn't make it without Shabbat. And so the relationship of Shabbat is a much deeper relationship. It's a relationship of love. I once heard somebody say the difference between lust and love is very simple. Lust is about taking. Love is about giving. And that's it in a nutshell. And so on Shabbat, we give of ourselves. That's what Shabbat is about. And I want to perhaps take a closer look at how Shabbat works and what Shabbat means from two perspectives. First, from the perspective of the textual significance of the Ten Commandments, as what Kadosh Baruch Hu, what God is trying to do when God gives over to us this concept of Shabbat in the text, what it means. And perhaps even to get a significance of what Shabbat being on the seventh day really means. What does that mean? So, let's take a look in this, in the Chumash, okay, in the Torah. And let's try to understand this. And I want you to know, this is a very deep idea, this concept of me relating to Shabbat and how it works. As a matter of fact, the Medrash, just while we're looking this up, the Medrash, there's a powerful Medrash in the Medrash Rabbah. It's in the legends, the allegories of the Torah. And the Medrash says, it's a very strange, I have to, by the way, maybe by way of explanation, explain, since we have a moment, the concept of Medrash. I don't know if you've heard mentioned here, the concept of Medrash. I know I've mentioned it a few times. Midrash, okay, is a word with all sorts of significance. It actually comes from the word lidrosh, okay, to seek out. There were two parts of the Torah. There are two parts of the tradition, right? Within the oral tradition, in other words, there's the written tradition, the actual Bible, and the oral tradition. Jay can give you a treatise on the concept of oral tradition from our discussion this morning, right? But the oral tradition really is that part that goes with the Bible, without which the Bible wouldn't make sense, right? We wouldn't understand. The laws of slaughtering an animal, for example, are nowhere to be found in the Bible. How to fill and look, what a mezuzah really is, etc. Most of the laws of Shabbat. They're not in the written traditions. There must be an oral tradition that goes alongside. People don't realize that the oral tradition as well, passed down from mouth to mouth, also has two parts. And those two parts are called halakha and agadah. Now halakha is very easy to define. Halakha literally comes from the word lalechet, halicha. We've mentioned that a couple of times. To walk. It's the system of walking through Judaism, through life. And it details every little last detail with regards to the technical aspects of how to apply this system of Judaism. If I'm not sure whether something is kosher, if I want to know how best to light the candles, if I want to know whether I wake up in such a fashion or the other fashion, if I want to know any legal question. This is both. In other words, but it's the oral tradition that we now have written down. Now why it's written down is a long discussion, but it's written down essentially because the Jewish people at a certain point were going to forget it, and we've lost something by virtue of the fact that it's written down. It was a sacrifice we made in order to maintain the oral tradition, but we lost it. It became written. That's very true. But halakha is all the laws. It's interesting, by the way, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, which is really the basic work that we follow today, was written by Rav Yosef Karo, who was a mystic, who lived in Tzfat, came from Spain. He begins his laws in the Code of Jewish Law with the laws of waking up in the morning. And he ends, there are four huge volumes, huge sets of laws that detail daily life, that detail law of the festivals, that detail laws of interaction and business between human beings, that detail laws of relationships between men and women, and that detail all sorts of laws of the forbidden and the permitted. The end of the whole system at the end of Yaradea is the laws of mourning. And the implication is that Jewish law, Jewish halakha, the Jewish system is with us from cradle to grave. The Rambam, Maimonides, has a very interesting approach. He begins his system, his code of Jewish law, on which, by the way, the Shulchan Aruch is based, with the laws called Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, the bases of Torah. And it's really a philosophical treatise. It's a discussion about the necessity of belief and what belief means and what God is and how I define God and how I develop a relationship with God. It's very much a work of philosophy, this whole first system of law. And it's clear that the Rambam believes, in fact, that philosophy in Judaism is a part of halacha, that I have an obligation to consider, to think, to process these ideas. He ends with the laws of king, of the kings, Hilchot Malachim, which deal essentially with the laws of redemption, of Messiah. In other words, the Rambam says that Jewish law carries us through this world into the next. It's a very interesting perception. But there are two parts to this oral tradition. So one is the laws, and that's very easy to write down. The other is what's called Agadah. Agadah are all of the deep philosophical ideas. People make a mistake. They think that they're stories. If you look in the Talmud, you'll very often come across stories in the Talmud. And in certain circles, people tend to take them less seriously, or they skip over them because they think, well, it's a nice story, but I want to get to the meat. And they don't realize that even though the Agadah, l'hagid, to tell over, these stories are only 5% of the oral tradition, as opposed to halakha, which is almost 95%. These stories are the pinnacle. The Gaon of Vilna, who lived in the 1700s, who was, by all accounts, a throwback to a previous generation, an incredibly brilliant mind, and without a doubt, sometimes you'll hear me say he was one of the greats of a generation. The Vilna Gaon was acknowledged as the greatest rabbi of his century. There was no one who came close to him. And an amazing figure. And he believed that all of the questions that we could possibly ever even begin to imagine to deal with in Israelite, is there a God? What does God mean? How do I develop a relationship with God? What does Shabbat mean? What are the mitzvot? How do I deal with prayer? What does it mean to have a chosen people? Anything you can imagine. Life in this world, life in the world to come, is God ethical? All the questions, human suffering, they're all dealt with by the Talmud in these agadic homilies, in these stories that contain very deep messages. The Agadah are these stories. Now, the rabbis used these stories and these ideas to teach these messages simply because when the time came to write these things down, it was very difficult to write them down. How do you write down a philosophical idea? To write down the halakha, Jewish law, that's very easy. 60 parts meat to one part milk. You got a problem, you write it down, that's it. No room for misinterpretation. But writing down a philosophical idea, you know, I've many times been asked by students, you know, we have a question on X, could you write us an answer? And I'm very hesitant to do it. Because very often, if I give a class on a topic, I mean, never mind trying to write down an answer, which takes 2 hours. But if I give a class on a topic, so very often a student will have difficulty with it. Or there'll be a dilemma. You finish Rabbi Cardoza's class, you've got to have questions, right? And how do you process it? And everybody has different questions. And it's very easy to walk away. I've heard students walk away from a class here at Israelite with two completely different interpretations as to what was said. So if it's oral, then that means that you have to relate to it. When something's written down, it's too easy to abuse it, to misinterpret it, to misunderstand it. And therefore, the rabbis had a problem how to write these things down. So they wrote them down in allegorical form, and they figured that somebody who was willing to take the time and trouble to understand this system and how it works would be ready to find the message contained therein. And somebody who wouldn't take their time, who wasn't ready to handle that kind of a message, so they'd have a nice story. But understand, therefore, that these stories contain very deep messages. So, the issue when you study, now Medrash, by the way, just as a term, is from the period of Tanaim, which is the Mishnaic period, from about 300 BCE until about 200 CE. And Agadah, Agarata, really refers to, it's an Aramaic word, refers to the period of the Talmud, of the, really, the period in Jerusalem and in Babylon from about 250, 230 till about 500 CE, even 600, when the Talmud itself was compiled, what we call the Gemara. Now this is Medrash, and it's from that period. Listen to Medrash. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Amar Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai said, the author of the Kabbalah, no slouch. Amar Shabbat Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Sabbath came before God. Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe. Lekulan Yesh Ben Zug. Everyone has a partner. Vali Ein Ben Zug, and I have no partner. Sunday has Monday. Tuesday is Wednesday. Thursday is Friday. I'm the odd man out. I'm Alei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So God said, Knesset Yisrael, Hi Ben Zugeich. The people of Israel will be your partner. V'kevan she'amdu Yisrael lifnei har Sinai. And when the Jewish people stood before Mount Sinai, Amar Lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said to them, Zichru HaDavar she'amarti leShabbat. Remember what I said to the Sabbath. Knesset Yisrael, he ben zugeich, that the people of Israel will be her partner. Hainu dibur zachorat yom haShabbat likadsho. And that's why the commandment says, according to the Medrash, remember the Sabbath day, likadsho, to keep it holy. Excuse me. What does that mean, to keep it holy? So the Medrash infers that there's an idea which is very similar to the concept of kiddushin. Kiddushin is the Jewish word for marriage. Marriage is not just an agreement of convenience. It's not just that two people love each other, they want to spend time together. It's a kedushin. It's a sanctity of purpose. And we have to understand that and what that has to do with Shabbat. What does it mean that Shabbat is related somehow to kedushin? How do I understand that? So in order to understand that, we have to look at the texts of Shabbat. And there are really three. There are four, but we'll take a look at three. The first is the most obvious. Where is the most obvious to begin studying Shabbat? Where would I start studying Shabbat? In the Torah? Yeah, if I was going to look in the Torah, where would I start studying Shabbat? Where's the first place Shabbat appears? In creation. So the world is created in 6 days. And then I get to chapter 2. This, by the way, is very interesting. You know, the Christians, the Catholic Church really, established the chapters. The chapter numbers here are not Jewish. In other words, When it says on the top of the page, chapter 1 or Perek Aleph, that was established by those who controlled the printing presses. Because the Christians obviously also used the Bible. And they, the canon, the church, at a certain point, I read an opinion that was probably around the 6th century, even though the printing press was later, they had their system in place. And when they printed, they passed the law, no one could print the Bible unless it used the Christian system. Right? This was sort of the church's way of imposing its philosophy on anybody who would study Bible. And by the way, you know, it wasn't like, you know, today, you know, if you want to use my press, you have to print it my way. But if you printed a Bible with the Jewish system, so it was punishable by death. It was blasphemy. So the Jews, and there are halachic discussions about this, and they decided en masse, all of the authorities, that because it was a question of danger and whatever, that therefore Bibles should be printed with this in a court, and sort of stuck. And we use it today, even the greatest, you know, in the yeshivot. But really it's a Christian idea. The Jewish idea, the Jewish concept of a chapter is very much different. It works on how the Torah scroll itself looks. If you look at the end of verse 31 in the Hebrew text, over here, you'll see that there's like a little opening, a paragraph. That's called a ptucha. It's an open-ended paragraph. And they count these, and that's how the chapters work. And this is a perfect example of part of the problem. Because if you look at the end of chapter 2, at the end of chapter 1, what does it say? Vayar Elokim et kol asher asa. And God saw all that he had made. Vehinei tov ma'od. It was very good. Vayarev evoker yom ha-shishi. And so the sixth day was over. And if you look at the beginning of chapter 2, it says, Vayechulu ha-shamayim v'aretz, v'chol tzvaam. All the heavens and the earth, everything was finished. In other words, at the end of the previous pasuk, God is telling us through the Torah somehow that he finished creation. So that's a good place to end the chapter. Except, of course, that in the Jewish perception, the chapter doesn't end there. Because the seventh day is not what followed the conclusion of creation. It is the conclusion of creation. Because on the seventh day, God created Shabbat. And God created the heavens and the earth, and God completed, or it was completed. Now it's very interesting. The word vayachal, right? Do you see that in the beginning of verse 1? Vayachulu. This is, by the way, the kiddush. We're not only studying Shabbat, we're actually studying the kiddush for Friday night. This is the text of the kiddush for Friday night, the first half. So what does it mean, Vayechulu Hashamayim Ve'aretz? Let me ask you a question. Okay? Verse 1. Vayechulu Hashamayim Ve'aretz V'chol Tzva'am. And the heavens and the earth were finished and everything in them. Right? Anything bother you about that verse? There's something that doesn't make sense there. Something that should say. I mean, this is real learning. Learning is analyzing a text and coming up with something that bothers you. What bothers you about that pasuk? Vayechulu ha-shamayim ve'aretz. And the heavens and earth were finished. Philosophically speaking, what bothers you? Pardon?
How could it be finished?
Okay, well, let's say that, we have to define what that means. Okay, let's define what that means. Let's say it means that the creative process that God underwent in those 6 days was finished. Now something else is going to happen, but that's a very good question. Okay. Okay. Anything else? Pardon? Well, man is created. Man is created in the sixth day. You can find man. In fact, in verse 26, God says, let us make man.
Okay.
No, but there's something missing here. Well, if not man, then who? Something missing in the verse. Maybe it's just me. And the heavens and earth were finished. Yeah, no.
Who did finish?
What do you mean they were finished? God finished them. What's the value of that verse? And they were finished.
As if they'd done it themselves?
First of all, yeah, it's a passive word, and it implies that, you know, the process was done. It's almost as though you don't see God in this verse.
First, is that a correct translation?
Yes, vayechulu. Well, you know what? What does the word kale mean? Kale, the root, kaf lamed hay, really means end. Now, it's a very interesting word. The root of it is actually kol, right? When you get to, the word kol means everything. Kaf lamed, okay? In fact, okay, this is the word kol. Everything, right? That's the word. Because when I get to everything, then I'm done.
And by the seventh day.
Right, And then in the next verse, exactly right, it says, Vayechal Elohim bayom ha-shvi'i. And on the seventh day, God finished. So what does that mean? First it says, everything was finished. And then it says, and God finished on the seventh day. So what was finished on the sixth day? So what's going on here? What is this finishing? Pardon? Well then, what's the seventh day? Well, so what is that? But I want to understand how that works within the verse. It should say then God finished, and then on the seventh day God created Shabbat. But it doesn't say that. It says that God completed on the seventh day the work that he did. Which means that on the previous day he had not yet completed the work that he did. Which makes the first verse that the heavens and earth were finished.
Maybe he created something beyond
the
heavens and
earth. Oh, so now we get into an answer. You see, there was something that was completed on the sixth day. But it wasn't God's work. You see, it's too easy to look at the 6 days of creation and see it as a complete act. And that's what I think the Torah is telling me. But it's not enough. Because there's something about the seventh day that completes the process. In other words, there is a difference. And we're talking about two different creative acts, and yet they're part of the same process. It's interesting, by the way, that the word kol, the rabbis say, is very much related to the word lech. The word lech, which we've pointed out a couple of times already, is so significant in Judaism, is exactly the opposite. It's a lamed, right? And then a chaf. This is right? It's exactly the opposite. Same numerical value. It's the inverse order. My journey through life to reach God is the inverse of God's journey to reach out to man. And we're supposed to meet somewhere in the middle. The numerical value, by the way, of this word is a very powerful numerical value because kaf, you know, every letter has a numerical value. The first letter, aleph, is 1, and the second is 2, and the yud is 10. So a kaf is equal to 20, and a lamed is equal to 30. The value of it numerically is 50. And 50 is a very powerful number. The Jewish people left Egypt on Passover, and they counted 7 weeks. Seven perfect sevens. On the 50th day, on Shavuot, they received the Torah. 50 is some sort of a completion of process. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that if we get to the number 7 in Shabbat. So what is this? How do I understand this process in terms of what's going on? And then it says, yeah. Oh, that's also very good. There's something about Shabbat which spells eternity. That's very good. In fact, the Maharal of Prague. Have you ever heard of the Maharal of Prague? Rav Lowy? No? The Maharal of Prague was a great rabbi who lived in the 1600s in Prague. In fact, if you go to Prague today, you can still see his synagogue. It still stands. So, there's a very strange legend. And it's one of those legends that just, it defies imagination. Because it's common to almost any source that you would expect to find such a legend. It's uniform in all of those sources, and yet it just sounds absurd. Like, you can't imagine how could, you know. So if it was a legend about 2,000 years ago, you'd just say it was some allegorical idea. But since we're talking about 300 years ago, you wonder about it. But the legend is that, you know, the Maharal of Prague was a great mystic. And he was also clearly one of the greats of his generation, acknowledged. And the Jewish community was undergoing in Prague at the time some very, very difficult circumstances, not least of which was an edict that was engineered by a cardinal who was determined to destroy the Jews of the area. And they realized that there was no way out, and the Jews were contemplating trying to leave, which was a very dangerous thing to do. So the legend is that the Maharal, based on some Kabbalistic, I don't know, although we have actually a manuscript, an original manuscript which we know, and it's been carbon dated, was written by his son, the son of the Maharal, who was, according to this manuscript, present, which is one of the reasons why the legend won't die, and describes not only the story, but the process of how it was done. But somehow the Maharal gathers together his son and two of his disciples, and they go down to the river. I forget the name of the river, the Vistula or whatever river it is in Czechoslovakia and Prague. You can look at it. The Danube, maybe?
Danube.
The Danube. They go down to the river, and he somehow Kabbalistically combines the four elements, the basic elements, earth and wind and fire and water. And he creates something called a golem. He recreates Kabbalistically the process of creation. And this golem is not quite a human being, but not an inanimate object. And there are all sorts of stories. Matter of fact, I once heard somebody suggest that the whole story of Fantasia is actually based on the Golem of Prague. But that's because people have a lot of time on their hands and do these things, maybe. But in any event, somehow this Golem of Prague is supposed to have somehow mystically a magnificent creature, strength, have saved the Jewish community. And at a certain point, it became clear that that it was dangerous to have this thing around. But you can't destroy life. You can only take the breath of life out of it. So the Maharal somehow undid what he did, but the golem itself as a piece of clay or whatever it is still exists. And the legend is that it's up in the attic of the synagogue of Prague. And that it stands there ready to protect the Jews. That's the legend. If you go to Prague and you ask the old Jews, they'll tell you that legend. What's really interesting is that my parents told me that when they were in Prague, that they heard another story, that you know, the synagogue in Prague is just about the only synagogue in the area left standing. The Maharal synagogue. Every other one was destroyed. And apparently there was a Nazi unit that came to Prague and that reached this synagogue. And there's a legend that there's an old door, and you can actually go and see this door that no one has the key to, that's never been opened since. That's where the golem is. And some Nazi officer with his troops runs up and tries to kick the door in and apparently falls backwards down the stairs dead. And then there's a second story that they'll tell you, this is what they told my parents, that that there was later in the war an SS sergeant who came. And the same thing happened, and he also died of a heart attack. And the legend spread that no one should mess with the shul, and the shul stands. I have no idea what this means. However, the Maharal, just so you understand, they don't tell stories like that about me. So the fact that they tell such a story about the Maharal tells you who the Maharal was. In other words, no one would get away making a story like that about me. So I tell you that to understand this comment. The Maharal makes your point. And the Maharal says that the 6 days are all completed. Vayerev, vayivoker, and there was night, and there was morning. And it was good. Vayar Elokim Kitov, and God saw it was good. On the seventh day, if you look, it doesn't say that. First of all, it doesn't say it was good, which is very strange. If I would think of one day when it should say it was good, I would think that it would be Shabbat. So how come on Shabbat it doesn't say it was good? And also, as you mentioned, Jay, there's no completion. There's no vayera, vayvoker, and it was finished. So Maharal says that's because, and this will lead us actually directly into what I wanted to talk about, Shabbat is something very different. Shabbat smacks of eternity. Shabbat is called, in rabbinic tradition, me'ein olam haba. It's a vestige of the world to come. Somehow there's something about Shabbat that's not like the other days. It's not that there are 7 days. There are 6 days, and then there's Shabbat. Now, in order to understand this, I'm going to have to do two things with you, which I have to admit I wouldn't do with the normal Israelite group, but I think that this group is up to the task. So I have to share. No, you'll see what I mean. I have to share with you two ideas. The first concerns the topic of Olam Haba. There's a beautiful, beautiful midrashic idea. And again, every time I mention midrash, I want you to remember that the issue is not whether it's literal or allegorical, but rather what I learned from the message. Now you have a little background to understand that statement. So the midrash says an incredible thing. It says, you know, it says here, right, that on the sixth day God created man. If you look at verse 26 in the previous page, Vayomer Elokim Naaseh Adam B'Tzalmeinu K'Dmuteinu, right? Adam says, let us make man in our image. And that's pretty much all you hear. And God says, you know, you should be fruitful and multiply. And that's about it. And all of a sudden, in the second, and that's the sixth day. And then I have the seventh day of Shabbat. And then in chapter 2, so I get into a whole discussion of the story of man. Well, God takes man and he puts him, look at verse 15. At the bottom of page 2, right? Chapter 2, Perek Bet Pasuk Tet Vav, verse 15. So God takes man, Vayikach Hashem Elokim et Adam, Vayanicheu Began Eden, he puts him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to guard it. So now this doesn't make much sense. Why? Because this should follow verse 26 on the previous page. It should say God made man and put him in the Garden of Eden. So now, some people look at this and they say, okay, there are two different styles here. And if you read the first chapter and the second chapter, they're two very different styles literarily as well. They say, oh, there must be two authors. And they call them A and B, or J, you know, depending on how you look at it, right? And they have different names because they're different authors. And I want you to know that everything in Torah study is a function of one original question. It's a question of perspective. And the whole way you look at Torah, the whole way you can study Torah, the whole symmetry of Torah is dramatically affected by this very simple question, which is who wrote it? And if, and that's obviously a longer discussion, but it's important that you understand my perspective. My perspective, and this is a long discussion, if anybody's curious, you know, we can find time on Shabbat to discuss it. My perspective is that it makes sense to me to say that God wrote the Torah, that this Torah is a divine work. If, however, you choose to say that the Torah is not divine, but man-made, then many of our discussions just fall away. Because there's no big deal if there are two different opinions in the Torah, if two things contradict each other, because two people wrote it, so they have two different opinions. But if, in fact, if you want to understand the whole nature of biblical criticism, which I think, by the way, I think it's tremendously valuable and important to study biblical criticism. I don't, you know, there are many different philosophies in Judaism, and different people have different opinions. And I've met people who believe, you know, biblical criticism is the root of all evil, and it says that the Torah is man-made, and you shouldn't study it, etc. I think that's a very dangerous attitude. I think it's a very negative attitude. I don't think it's at all what HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what God wanted us. I think the opposite is true. We should be able to study different opinions and see the beauty in them. And if you want to disagree with something, you have to know what it says. If so many brilliant people accept something, so then, you know, you have to study it and be able to have a certain amount of respect for it, and then you can disagree with it. In other words, I may agree with evolution, or I may disagree with evolution. I happen to think, by the way, that evolution is not at all problematic in terms of the study of Torah. I have my problems with evolution from a scientific perspective. It's a theory which is more and more, or less and less, I should say, being accepted by the scientific community. But my problem with evolution is not that it contradicts Torah. Evolution doesn't contradict Torah at all. In fact, evolution makes a lot of sense with the Torah. If evolution is the way the world was created, then it'd be very easy to fit it into the Torah. Right? Man was created on the sixth day, and animals were created on the fifth day, and before that you had fish, and you had lower life creatures, and water. It'd be very easy. And we know, of course, that a day is not a day, because the sun is created on the fourth day, if you look in the Bible right here, which means that the first 3 days are not days as we know them. Because our definition of a day is the revolution of the world in relationship to the sun. If there's no sun, then there's no 24-hour day. So obviously a day isn't a day. So whatever a day means, pardon?
It's a good point.
Yeah. And right. In other words, whatever the word day means here, it doesn't mean day as we know. And perhaps a longer discussion is why I think that's true about the second, the fourth, fifth, and sixth day. But the word day here is clearly congruent and it's clearly symmetrical. And therefore, there are six units of time called a day. And the issue for the Torah is not how long that day was. Just that there are six periods of time. And that those six periods, those six units, reflect six different stages in creation. So it wouldn't be very difficult at all to fit evolution into the Torah. I just don't think that the Torah is interested in whether the world came about through evolution. The Torah is much more interested in what happened when God created the world. You know, it's like the difference of looking at the first creative verse. Yomer Elohim, and God said, let there be light. That's a very powerful idea. And God said, let there be light. And science is fascinating. What does that mean, let there be light? So science has the Big Bang theory, that the world was created with the Big Bang. And if you study some, I'm not a scientist, but as a layman, if you study a certain amount of scientific theory, they've discovered the frequency of the Big Bang. They've discovered that the universe is not a static universe, but an expanding universe. There are many different reasons. If you read Carl Sagan's book, it's the most amazing book. Well, I want to tell you, he did a tremendous service to us as human beings with the knowledge that he gave us. And I read this book. Somebody lent me the big one. You know, they have a big copy with magnificent photographs, space telescopes, exploding stars and novas. And he describes the whole process and how many different pieces have to fall into place for each creative act to be. The thing that most blew me away about this book, by the way, was that at the end he concludes it's all random. I look at this book, and I guess it's a question of perspective. I look at this book, I think, how could you look at that and see it as random? But okay, everybody has their perception, right? But science is fascinating. And by the way, it makes a lot of sense. If the sun is created on the fourth day, so then what's the light on the first day? It can't be the sun. So the light is energy. We have light all the time without the sun. And if there was a Big Bang, there must have been a tremendous release of energy. It'd be very easy to say that God created the world with a Big Bang. But that's what it means, Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or. But the Torah isn't interested in the Yehi Or. They're not interested in how the Or. The Torah is interested in asking, did you hear the Vayomer Elokim, that God said, let there be light? If you see the light, but you don't hear that God said it, then the Torah says, well, then you're missing something. And that's a question of perspective. So my perspective, it's very important if we're going to learn Torah together, to realize, you know, you can accept it or deny it, but at least you know where I'm coming from. In other words, I study Torah from the perspective that it's divine, that it's from God. Okay. That being the case, I want to understand, what does it mean that Shabbat is Me'ein Olam Haba? Is that some kind of a part of the world to come? So it's very interesting. Adam, right, is created, and we started this question, and then God puts him into a different place. So if it's really one unit, so why does the Torah set it up this way? It should really say that, you know, God creates the world, creates man, and puts him in the Garden of Eden. So there are two very different ideas in the first and second chapter. The first chapter deals with the world. It deals with what God gives to us. And then the second chapter deals with what we do with it. So the rabbis asked an interesting question. He said, okay, fine. So what was Adam doing? I mean, if you look at the Torah, it seems God created Adam on the sixth day. And then he created Shabbat. And then Adam, you have this whole story with the Garden of Eden and they eat the fruit and all this stuff. So the Medrash says, don't be fooled. This whole story in chapter 2 really happened on the sixth day. God created Adam, put him in the Garden of Eden. He gives him one mitzvah. It's very interesting. You know, Bill Cosby has this great tape. He says, God doesn't say, it's incredible, it's phenomenal, it's radical, it's phantasmical. He just says it's good. You know, we come up with all these words. God says, it's good. So God sees everything and says it's good. Who doesn't get a good man? It doesn't say God created man was good. Because God creates man, and man has to make it good. Right? I mean, man is very different from all the other animals. And God gives man one mitzvah. One mitzvah. What's the mitzvah? What's the command? So what does God tell Adam and Eve? Not to eat from the tree. Now, it's a very interesting philosophical question why the first thing that God tells a human being is not to do something. I would have thought the opposite, right? If you look in verse 16, Vayetzav Hashem Elokim al Adam, very good. God says to man, right? Mikol Eitz Hagan Achol Tochel, you can eat from everything. U'mi'eitz Hadat Tovara Lo Tochal Mimenu. But you can't eat from the tree of knowledge, of good and evil. No, he puts him there in order to tell him to keep it. He doesn't tell him to tell him to keep it. That's the purpose, whatever that means.
But he does say he's just
good. Okay, so now that's a very interesting question. So in fact, you have hit upon something that the Ramban says, Rav Moshe ben Nachman. So you guys should be already in yeshiva, because I see you're already in medieval commentators, right? The Ramban really makes this point in some form, as I understand the Ramban. He really says, I mean, from a technical standpoint, if I say to you, listen, I don't mind what you're doing here, but please don't have a wrestling match. So what have I essentially said? I've said, don't have a wrestling match in here. You wouldn't say he told us two things. We could do anything, and we can't have a wrestling match. So that's the normal way people look at that. But in fact, I think you're right. Really, God is telling man two things. He's really telling him, okay, the first mitzvah is not to eat from the tree. I mean, that's a mitzvah. In fact, it's interesting. This is something for a course on kashrut, which is in the next Israelite session, but this is really the first instance of something being unkosher. God tells man that the tree of knowledge is not kosher for him. So that's the first mitzvah. So really, the first mitzvah is not to do something. That's really true. And yet you're right. God tells man, you have to, you know, you can eat from the tree, right? So the truth is that what God gives man there is the ability to choose. Because man has a difficult thing. It's a difficult decision to make now. He wakes up the next morning, he has to decide, what's he going to eat? Is he going to eat oranges? Is he going to eat apples? Is he going to eat pears? That's not so easy. And in fact, and this is a longer discussion for another time, but in fact, it's an interesting question because there's no halachic framework for that. The halacha doesn't tell me I have to eat oranges or apples or pears. So how do I arrive at that type of a decision? In other words, the halacha will tell me that if I'm a priest, there may be a problem with my being a doctor. Because a priest is not supposed to come into contact with a dead body. So that's a question. You have to deal with it. And the rabbis may tell me that if I'm walking on the path and I see a piece of food on the ground, then I have to pick it up. So there are all sorts of discussions. But what about if I have a dilemma? I'm not sure, should I be a doctor or a lawyer? So the halacha doesn't tell me which is better. How do I make that decision? How do I struggle with the decisions in life that God doesn't seem to want to give me? That's an interesting question. But I want to bring out another point. And if you're curious as to a response to that question, I will be glad to get to it. But look, you want to know something. The truth is, this is the beauty of Torah study. You want to really know the beauty of Torah study? The beauty of Torah study is you can't just study for an hour. You can't. I challenge you to find any class of Torah, of real Torah, that doesn't open up windows for another class. That's the beauty of it. That's the problem with running a program for a week. But I will tell you this. So the Midrash says, okay, so what was Adam doing? So Adam was doing all this stuff, not eating from the tree, etc. And he gets himself into trouble, right? I mean, why does it say by every living creature that God created it and it was good, and by man it doesn't? Because that's the truth. When God creates the fish, the fish don't say we don't want to swim in the ocean. God creates a fish, they're supposed to swim in the ocean, that's what they do. God creates the tree, they're supposed to go on land, that's what they do. God creates man, says to man, don't eat from the tree. What does man answer? Where is it? I mean, that's how we are. So man messes up. We mess up, and we eat from this tree, whatever that means. Say the rabbis, all of this happens on Erev Shabbat, on Friday afternoon, on the sixth day. God tells man, you're in the Garden of Eden. He says, don't eat from the tree. The snake comes along, has a little hoopah with Chava, whatever's going on there, Eve. She eats, man eats, the snake eats, everybody's eating, everybody's happy, and God gets upset. And they're exiled from the Garden of Eden. All of this happens Friday afternoon, for Shabbat. And then, Shabbat. So now imagine this for a moment. The rabbis say, God realized that to kick man out of the Garden of Eden was a very painful thing. So he gave him Shabbat. And Shabbat is a taste of the world to come, of the Garden of Eden, or the world that he left, or the world he's striving to return to. Because man's journey in the world is another window. I'll give you a quick idea. If you think about it, it's a very difficult problem. It's one of the deepest philosophical problems with regards to man's choice of good and evil. What is the tree that man was going to eat from supposed to signify? Knowledge between good and evil. If they eat from the tree, they're going to know the difference between good and evil, right? What does that mean? Before they eat from the tree, they don't know the difference between good and evil, right? So how are they responsible for eating from the tree? They don't know the difference between good and evil. You understand the dilemma? If I already know the difference between good and evil, then what's the tree? And if I don't know the difference between good and evil, then how am I held responsible for what I do? So there are many different answers that are given. The Ramban has a tremendous answer. He says, man knew what the difference between good and evil was before he ate from the tree. He knew what was good. What was good was what God said to do. What was evil? What God didn't say to do. So that was very simple. But man didn't understand the consequence of evil until eating from the tree. He needed to experience it. What happens? God says, now, this is a very difficult point because it means that man was meant to be in the Garden of Eden, eat from the tree, and then leave. So what's the whole point? How does that work? So there are two very important ideas here. The first is that our idea of punishment is very, very different, let's say from the, I mean, I don't consider myself an expert, but from the Catholic idea, as I understand it anyway. Punishment is not punishment. In fact, it's interesting, there's a concept, at least in Catholicism, as I understand it from what little I've read, called purgatory, eternal damnation. The concept does not exist in Judaism. There's no point to eternal damnation. If somebody's eternally punished forever, then there's no value to the punishment. The purpose of a punishment is that it achieves something. If all it achieves is that you're punished forever, then it doesn't get anything. If I kick a kid out of class, so I failed with that kid. There may be a value for the class, but I failed with that kid. If I kick a kid out of class on the last day of class, so that's pointless. If I kick him out forever, that's pointless too. He's not going to get anything out of that. So therefore, the concept of punishment is very different in Judaism. In Judaism, the concept of punishment means consequence. We're on a journey. We're on a path. And we make decisions in the path. And sometimes those decisions lead us to the goal, and let's call the goal a closer relationship with God, becoming a more ethical person. And every time we come to a fork in the road, a decision, so we might take the right path, we might take the wrong path. Well, there's a consequence to taking the wrong path. You still have to get to that goal. Now it becomes a little more difficult. And sin actually means, in Hebrew, the word for sin is chet, which means to miss the target, lahachti et amatara. I just missed the road. It's like the Robert Frost poem, famous poem, right? Two roads diverged in a word, and I have taken the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. That's what he read at John F. Kennedy's inauguration. It's a very powerful idea. That, you know, Judaism may well be a road less traveled by, but it makes all the difference which path you take. So Adam takes a path, and he's now paying the consequence. And that's an inevitable consequence. If you do X, then the consequence is Y. Right? If I put my hand in the oven, the consequence is it's going to get burned. It's not a punishment. It's the consequence of putting my hand in the oven. It's important for man to have done two things. To experience the consequence of evil, and to have tasted of the world to come. Think about it. What is the Garden of Eden? What, there's a place where God hangs out? And then you leave, so you can't be with God? God's everywhere. But of course, it's not that God exiles man. Man exiles himself. The consequence of sin, of making that mistake, of walking down that wrong path, is that you're a little further away from the goal. You're a little further away from God. Shabbat is the ability to somehow get back on track. And that's why it's called the taste of the Garden of Eden. Because the Garden of Eden represents a direct relationship with God. And leaving the Garden of Eden means that we get distracted, that it's more difficult. In fact, the consequence of man's sin is Bezeyata pecha tochal lechem. By the sweat of thy brow will you eat bread. What does that mean? So I mentioned this morning that bread is representative of man's doing something with the world. You have to make the world. If you want to get, I gave you the Garden of Eden. It was all there. Now you have to make the world into a Garden of Eden. And by the way, this pattern exists in the entire Bible. First God does it, and then we have to do it ourselves. God takes us out of Egypt. He puts us through 10 plagues. He does all the work. Right? We get to Sinai. He gives us the Torah. So God does everything. If you look at the story of the Jews in the desert, it's almost a repeat of the process. Now the Jewish people have to get out of Egypt on their own. And they have to develop a relationship with Torah on their own. And they have to enter and conquer the land on their own. They, having experienced God's magnanimous hand, whatever that means, now have to come to it on their own, because otherwise it has no value. That's the idea of Shabbat. On Shabbat, I'm retasting, I'm re-experiencing. I'm getting an idea of what it could be like. It's sort of a re-motivator. That's part of the idea of Shabbat. The Ramban is saying, look, what would the world be if we lived in the Garden of Eden? The whole purpose is that God makes us God's partner in creation. That he gives us an imperfect world. A world with a snake. Because I wouldn't appreciate the mountain I can climb if there wasn't a valley. And that's the beginning of the journey. Mankind leaving the Garden of Eden. That's an essential part. But I'll give you one more idea since you brought it up. So what is this? This tension between man being told that he can make his own decision and God making the decision for us. And that's an interesting question. If you look back in the time of the Bible, so we didn't really have to make a decision. Why? Because we had prophets. I mean, what's our perception of a prophet? Right? If I don't know what the decision is, I go to my prophet. Best example I could think of is that at the beginning of the book of Samuel, Saul, who will become king, loses his donkey. He doesn't know where to find it. He doesn't know where to find the donkey. And he goes looking for the donkey, and then suddenly he realizes, wait a second, why do I have to figure out where the donkey is? I'll go ask the prophet. He goes to the prophet, and he asks the prophet, where is the donkey? And for some reason, there's some problem with this. The Bible seems to present this as problematic. What's the problem? If there's a prophet, the prophet knows the answer. Why not? So that relates very much to what I was saying before. So Adam has to make this decision. And by the way, if you think about it, every great leader in Jewish history has to make the same decision. I'll give you an example. Moses. Moses is brought up in the palace of Egypt. And he leaves the palace of Egypt. And it says, Vayetze lirot et echav, vayar besivlotam. He sees his brother's suffering. I have to see if that's the exact wording, but he sees his brother's suffering. And he sees Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian, hitting a Jew. And it says Vayifan Kovako, and he looks back and forth, Vayar Ki Enish, he sees there's no man there. Right? And he does what he does, he kills the Egyptian, he hits the Egyptian ends up dying. So what is Moshe doing? Moshe has a difficult decision to make. Now there's no book of Halacha, there's no Torah given yet, he doesn't have a way, he has to make that decision. It's a very difficult decision. What do you do? And by the way, I'm not so sure that the Halacha would have agreed with Moses' decision. It doesn't appear that the Jew was actually in danger in terms of his life. And then Moshe is forced into exile and he has to make another decision. And we see this all through the Bible. How do you find this ability to make these decisions? So we very often try to avoid the decision. How do we avoid the decision? Well, we ask a prophet. So you say, well, we don't have prophets today. It's not true. We make our own prophets. You know, in the yeshiva world, for example, if a person doesn't know, you know, what to do, so what does he do? He goes, he asks his Rebbe. Maybe first he looks, you know, in a code of Jewish law. So the Jewish book tells me what to do. And if the book doesn't know, so, you know, I'll look it up on the Bar Ilan computer program or I'll go to my rabbi. And the rabbi will make the answer for me. And that's a problem. Why? Because it means that I'm missing a certain part of that process. What am I missing? So there are two concepts, and these concepts are a tension one against the other. One is called hishtadlut. Lehishtadil is to try. That we're struggling with our existence in this world. The other is called bitachon, what they call in the yeshiva world bitachon, faith. And these two ideas conflict each other, right? If I don't know what to do, I'm not sure. Should I take this job? Should I take that job? Should I go left? Should I go right? So I should just have faith. Whatever it will be, God will work it out, right? God wants me to succeed, so God, you know. You want to go on a blind date? Well, you know, what's the difference? If God wants me to meet the girl, so I'll meet her. So I don't meet her on a blind date, so she'll come in the office. And if God doesn't want me to meet her, it won't even matter if I go on the blind date. So what's the point of going on a blind date? No. So the rabbis say, no, but that's not true, because you also have to have hishtaglut. You have to do your bit. Now, the question is, though, if you're doing your bit, doesn't that imply a lack of faith? Because you're saying, you're right, but let me explain why. You're saying, right, that if I do my bit, so for that moment, I'm assuming that I'm a part of the process. Really, it all depends on God. And it does all depend on God, supposedly. So obviously the rabbis are interested in a partnership. And they're interested in me being involved in the world. That's not a simple issue, by the way. It's like the question of nature and miracles. So we look at nature, and we look at miracles as two different things. I'll give you a great example that I once heard. If you're walking along a cliff one day, and you're jogging, right? And you run off the cliff. You don't realize it. You're so into your run, you run off the cliff. 2,000-foot cliff. This is not a good day. But there's a tree growing out of the side of the cliff. You grab the tree, you hang on to it. And you manage to climb your way back up. So do you view that as a miracle? Well, you may become religious for an hour, you know. But I mean, do you view that as a miracle? Yeah, maybe right then you say, oh, it's a miracle. You know, you might say, thank God, nobody's listening. But I mean, right? Now let's say it's not that a tree was growing out of a cliff. Let's say that on that particular morning there happens to be a guy who's practicing rope throwing. I don't know, there's nothing better to do with that. It's just a guy who wants to practice rope throwing off this particular cliff, and he happens to be practicing rope throwing just as you run off the cliff by accident. And you grab this rope and it saves you. And there's no tree. A miracle. Now you're religious for 2 hours. But then you start to say, okay, so I was lucky. So you don't view it as a miracle, but you kind of view it as, wow, okay. But then let's say that you're running off the cliff, and you take off into space, and you look down, and you're going to die. And an angel with wings comes down and picks you up and puts you back up on top of the cliff. Well, now you're religious for a whole week, right? I mean, wow, what a miracle. But it could well be that the reason that we perceive those three things differently is only our misperception. Because how do I know but that God planted that tree on the side of that cliff so that one day when Benny Friedman would go jogging and mess up and fall off the cliff, it would be there. In other words, how do I know that tree is any less of a miracle than that angel? It's only a question of my perception. Or is it a question of my perception? In fact, there's an incredible allegoric story. I believe it's a story of Rabbi Hanina, but I might be getting the name wrong. And the story goes that Rabbi Hanina was this tremendous, tremendous Torah scholar, mystic, you know, almost miracle worker in the Talmud. And he comes home one Shabbat afternoon, one Friday afternoon, and the whole family is upset. He was a very poor person, and they ran out of oil. They had nothing to light Shabbos candles with, which already gives you a perspective. You know, if you had no money, what most people would be upset with, well, you know, there's no food. No, they were upset about oil for Shabbos candles. Okay. So he walks in, and he says, okay, what's the problem? We have vinegar, don't we? So they said, yeah. So he says, okay, so we'll use vinegar. And that's how the story ends. The vinegar, they lit Shabbos candles with vinegar. And of course, there's only one little problem. You can't light Shabbos candles with vinegar. So what does this mean? Oh, great miracle, right? You know, Rabbi Chanina was such a great person that Shabbos candles got lit with vinegar. So Rav Dessler, who writes an incredible book called the Michtav Meliyahu, Letters from Elijah, he lived in the last generation, 20 years ago, 30 years ago in England, and his volumes are actually over here, magnificent works. He says a tremendous thing. He says, what does that mean? The reason that I look at a miracle as a miracle is because I may have a misperception of nature. I look at the world of nature, and I assume, you know, it's like I'm going to a business meeting, and I want to get to that business meeting, right? And I say, listen, God, just do me a favor. Don't mess things up. Don't make a traffic jam. Just stay out of it. Let nature run its course. I'll get there on time. It'll be fine. So what am I essentially saying? I'm essentially saying that there's nature and then there's God. But there's a higher level of an appreciation of nature, and that is that nature is God. In other words, it's like the difference between looking through a keyhole and seeing God as a pen who writes the world, right? There's a hand holding a pen, and the pen is writing the world. So you might think that's a magnificent thing, but of course the fact that I need a pen means that my hand is incapable of doing it without the pen. So there's a deficiency in that perception. Perhaps nature is God. In other words, if I view nature as a miracle, then every miracle is only natural. And that may well have been Rabbi Chanina's perception. He says, what do you mean? It's an incredible miracle that oil burns. So normally God does a miracle through oil. Today he'll do it through vinegar. What's the difference? Rav Dessler goes a stage further and he says the whole reason that we have nature and miracles is because that's our challenge, to transcend that, to be able to perceive God within nature. But Rabbi Chanina already reached that level, so he didn't need that veil. So for him, you could burn vinegar. Now, what that means is a longer discussion. But that's essentially what's going on. In other words, within this framework, the question ultimately is my perception of God. I leave the Garden of Eden, and I look at the world. Do I see the miracle in nature and the nature in the miraculous? That's also a part of Shabbat. It allows me to appreciate that balance. On Sunday, Bezrat Hashem, and on Monday, I'm going to give you a perception of how one can look at that through history, what the real meaning philosophically of history is within the Jewish framework, and how that affects our understanding of human suffering as well, and whether we can believe in a God considering all of the suffering in the world. But that's one of the essential ideas of Shabbat, to find that balance.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.